Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Kelly Horowitz, representing appellant Elsa Chavez. Your honors, as happy as I am to be here this morning, I should not be here. This case was filed in state court. It's exclusively state law claims. The appellee chose to remove it to federal court on diversity grounds, and at that point, the appellee took on the burden of proving by a preponderance of evidence that the amount in controversy exceeds $75,000. Well, wasn't
she? How old was she at the time of the termination?
63.
And she wanted to work until she was 72, correct?
Correct.
And she was earning at least $39,000 a year, correct?
Correct.
So that's, by calculation, $351,000, right? Lost wages.
The math is correct, Your Honor, but I would respectfully say that the time period for calculating the damages under the law is incorrect. It needs to be at the time of removal. At the time of removal, she had been unemployed for 13 months.
So you think the standard is how much damages had accrued by the time of removal, or at the time of removal, what was the likely, what damages were being required, if you accepted the theory of the plaintiff, what would the damages be? What is the authority for the proposition that it has to be accrued damages at the time of the removal?
At the time of removal, Krosky, for example, a Ninth Circuit case from 2005, supports the proposition that the damages are to be determined at the time of her removal.
But meaning what?
What
meaning that they have to have accrued by then? That's what you're arguing.
Yes, that is what I'm arguing. And that has also been, there's language in Matheson as well that supports that interpretation. And there are, the district courts have interpreted your cases to mean that you look at the wages up at the time, calculate up until the date of removal.
And you can't consider anything in the future? For example, you have a claim for loss of earnings and loss of earning capacity. And we can't consider any of that?
That is our position. And further...
And what's your best case for saying that we can't consider earning capacity? You want to recover that money, right? You're not waiving this.
No, we are not waiving this.
Okay,
but
so you're not waiving the $350,000 that Judge Woodcock referred you to.
No, we are not waiving that by any means.
Okay, so you do want that money. That is part of your prayer for relief, if we were to put a number on it.
It is part of the prayer of relief, but the problem is it is the appellee's burden to make that case, and they
right,
didn't do that.
Right, but how difficult is that? If your client is earning just around $40,000 a year, all you need is 2 years. You already missed 13 months, so there's half of the $75,000 in past wages. You had medical expenses, you had attorney's fees, you had the $750 that you wanted under the 226 claim. All you need is 1 year of earning capacity, and she asked for earning capacity. If you were going to give her one more year, which is not too difficult to get to, and she said she wanted another 9 years.
Your Honor, I appreciate the suggestion that my client can and should get a huge amount of money, but the problem is the law on removal does not allow one.
All right, I just looked at Krosky, and it doesn't say. I don't see this, what you're talking about. I don't see such a statement. I don't even see the statement that it's supposed to be as of the removal date. I don't even see that.
I do not have the full case in front of me, Your Honor, but page 980, the court is looking at evidence that was relevant to the amount in controversy at the time of removal.
Well, that's always true. You always evaluate it at the time of the removal, but the claim is what the claim is, including future claims. Do you have any authority that a court is hamstrung by what is in the past only?
Again, I would say that your authority is being interpreted by the district courts in that manner.
Counsel, this is a pretty fundamental point. This is pretty important for district courts on diversity jurisdiction. We've been doing this a long time. I've never heard of this principle that you've been citing to us. I taught civil procedure for 10 years. I've never heard of this. Okay. Have you got a good case for us that tells us that we can't consider a claim for future lost wages?
Well, I do have cases that say you can't rely on good faith belief alone, and that is all that the appellees have brought to you. They brought you in their removal.
I think you should get to the merits of the case.
Okay, Your Honor. With respect to the merits of the case, the clearest error, I would say, is the Labor Code Section 226 interpretation.
Okay, if you win on that, do you get $750?
We do.
And do you get anything more than that?
We don't, which again, I guess, goes back to the jurisdictional question, that the one clear damage amount in this entire case is a $750 claim.
Okay, what next?
Okay. So briefly on Labor Code Section 226, the district court imposed a knowing and intentional requirement saying that in order for there to be any liability, the employer needs to knowingly and intentionally refuse to provide employment records. There is nothing in the statute that says that, and obviously elsewhere in the statute, they do impose a knowing and intentional requirement, which further supports our interpretation that there is no such relevant requirement.
Let's move to the other ones. Disability, age, medical leave.
Okay. The California Family Rights Act, the district court ruled that the law is not sufficiently broad to protect employees who put their employers on notice that they're requesting or planning or need CAFR leave. That is not the state of the law in California. In fact, the law is broadly construed, and once there's any suggestion by an employee that they may need medical leave, the burden then shifts to the employer to provide information to the employee about the opportunity.
Where is the evidence that she requested medical leave?
She repeatedly told her supervisor, I'm having these medical issues. My arm is going numb. I'm having headaches. I have this anxiety and the stress, and I can't take vacation. The question of whether that's adequate notice is one for the trier of fact, but when your employee says to you, I'm having medical problems and I can't take any vacation time, it's a reasonable interpretation to say, as a trier of fact, oh, gee, well, maybe then at that point the employer needs to step up and say, you don't have to take vacation time if you're having medical problems. Let me tell you about this thing called family and medical leave. With respect to both of the discrimination claims,
do you have any case that's close in terms of facts? In other words, from what she said, one has to infer that she wants to take some time off.
Exactly.
It's not that big an inference, but it's an inference. She doesn't say, I'd like to take some time off, or I need to take time off, or anything like that. Even when she says, I can't take vacation, it's not even clear what that means. It may mean I can't take vacation because I'm not feeling well. I don't know what it means.
Right, but I think in the context of saying that my arm is going numb and I'm having these medical problems, it is a reasonable inference that a trier of fact could draw.
Do you have a case?
Well, both Moreno and Soria do say that the request for notice does not require any specific form. And actually, this is the one I was looking for because we actually argued it previously in California, Avila versus Continental Airlines. There were also questions about whether Mr. Avila was adequately requesting leave, whether the notice was sufficient when they got word that he'd had a hospital visit.
The notice wasn't here. The question wasn't whether the notice was sufficient. There wasn't notice. That's clear.
Well, the question is whether when she said that they were on adequate notice that
the notice to her, to them. I understand.
Yeah, yes.
I'm sorry. Okay.
My apologies. The notice to her employer that she may be in need of protected leave. And at that point,
quickly, you want to address the ADA and age issues.
Both of those were dismissed on as not having met their prima facie burden. That's obviously a very low burden, legal burden.
Well, let me
yes, ma'am.
Ask you that. I mean, the central question here, whatever box you put it in, was whether she was, in fact, doing her job in an acceptable way. Now, does that go into the prima facie case? I had always understood that the prima facie case was much lower than that. I mean, that is she eligible or in the sense that she, you know, has whatever prerequisites are required to, for the job? And because the evaluation problem is the substantive problem here, right? You're saying that the evaluation wasn't a fair evaluation. Are you saying that? Or are you saying it wasn't reported properly, or what exactly?
There are a couple of pieces to it. One is when you look at the entire universe of evaluations, on the one hand, she's being told mid-year, you need to improve. And then the employer will come along and say, well, okay, you know, we've seen improvement. You're meeting our expectations. Low meets expectations was the category they would put it in. And in fact, even when she was on her performance improvement plan, her supervisor is giving her an evaluation that says she's meeting expectations. So first off, we think, at least as a prima facie matter, which is what the court categorized this as, there is sufficient evidence to show that she had performed her job adequately. And in particular, the treatment of her replacement, when Ms. Serta comes along and she runs into the same problems generating loans in that office, she was not terminated. And that is a factor.
But they say she wasn't terminated either. In fact, she was offered a job and didn't take it.
Well, ultimately, she was terminated from this position. She had another job offer on the table when
they
terminated her.
Well, that's the same as the other person. They were given a different job. She was given a different job. She didn't take it.
She didn't take one job that she was offered. The evidence in the record is that while she was in the hospital, the HR people reached out to her and said, well, what about this job offer that we'd like to give you? And she said, I can't address this right now. I'm in the hospital. She came back to work a day or two later, and that's when she gets fired, while she has a pending job offer.
But I thought there was also a job that she was offered.
There was one job that
she refused it because of the salary.
Because of wages.
There were two jobs that were offered.
She had one that she couldn't agree on with respect to salary and the
other. I'm asking you a conceptual question.
Yes, ma'am.
Which is, in terms of the evaluations, is it, as I understand it, the district judge here said that there was no prima facie case because she wasn't qualified, because she didn't meet the expectations of the job. Was that a legitimate place to have done that analysis? And then he stopped, right?
Correct.
Or does one have, because if you do it that way, you never get to the question of whether those evaluations were legitimate evaluations.
Exactly. So we certainly think.
But are you challenging the evaluations? You're not really. What you're challenging is simply the evaluation of the evaluations. And in other words, you're saying, well, they really weren't as bad as represented.
Correct. And that when another employee came along who couldn't meet the same standards, she had a different outcome.
One of the elements of a prima facie case is the employee was performing competently in the position she held. Isn't that correct? Isn't that your burden?
It is.
It's a low burden. Well, isn't that your burden?
Is that the requirement, or is that she'd be qualified for the job, which I always understood meant she had, you know, whatever prerequisites were required, and, you know, she was... she could read, write, and so on. And she had a bachelor's degree if it was required.
Right.
But what is the articulation? Is it that she'd be competent at the job, or that she be qualified in a minimal sense?
Well, certainly our position would be at the prima facie stage, given the low level of it. You ought to look at her minimum competence for the job, which she certainly had exhibited. She'd been in this field for 30 years. She'd been in this particular job for 2.5 years. She kind of bounced back and forth in her evaluations as to whether or not she was meeting expectations. But she was, you know, there is evidence she was meeting expectations along the way, even as late as just a couple months before
termination.
Okay, your time
is up. I'll give you a minute, rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sherry Suica. I'm here on behalf of Chase Bank. And I thought I would just address a few points that were made in the reply. On the jurisdictional issue, there was an argument in the reply that Ms. Chavez is no longer pursuing her claim for failure to hire, which would be relevant to the $39,000 annual salary. And instead, this is now just a termination case, and that we had not pointed to the evidence of what she was making in
A plaintiff has the opportunity to waive certain kinds of damages, and we do see these kinds of things where somebody will waive anything above $75,000 in order to keep it in state court. And I don't see that waiver was, if it was done in the reply brief, that's pretty late, especially when both sides seem to have stipulated to the diversity jurisdiction of the district court.
And I don't even interpret the reply brief to be waiving anything. That's not my interpretation, but I thought I would just point out that I did find in the record, it's in the second volume of the excerpts, on page 256, lines 14 through 18, Ms. Chavez testified in her deposition that on average with her commissions and salary, she was making about $45,000 a year in her mortgage banking position, which again would meet the jurisdictional prerequisite.
Well, 1 year wouldn't, but you're saying she needs 2 years? What does she need?
Well, 2 years plus attorney's fees, emotional distress. I looked at the Krosky case that was cited, and a direct quote from that case on page 980 is that the amount in controversy includes the amount of damages in dispute, as well as attorney's fees if authorized by statute or contract. And here, under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, if the plaintiff prevails, she's entitled to her attorney's fees.
Now, obviously, that doesn't exist at the time of the removal, because it hasn't happened yet.
Right. I don't think that's a correct statement of the law. I mean, this court has held many times that the amount in controversy is the amount at stake in the litigation, and it includes any result of the litigation, excluding interest and costs, that entails payment by the defendant. Now, certainly, if Ms. Chavez were to prevail, she would have been entitled to her attorney's fees, any emotional distress damages. I think the $75,000 threshold is easily met.
Family leave. She basically says, the employee goes up and says, I'm having these medical problems, I'm out of vacation. She doesn't know all the inner workings, the details of your family leave policy. Doesn't the employer have some obligation to turn to the employee and say, well, we do have this program for you?
Actually, the California regulations do enumerate the elements of when the employer is obligated to make that inquiry. First, there needs to be a request for time off. And second, the employee needs to tell the reason for the time off. And that reason needs to be qualifying under the statute. And third, the employee needs to tell the employer how much time is anticipated.
You mean before there's any application to say there's a leave?
Yes, well, this is directly from the regulation. And here, you know, maybe her vague statement about not being able to take vacations, even, you know, liberally construed as a request for time off, she still doesn't say, I need to take X weeks off to figure out what's going on with my arm and my headaches.
How do you square with the Continental Airlines case that counsel cited?
That the Continental Airlines case, I'm not quite sure about the facts of that case. I'm not prepared on that, but I do know under the Soraya case, which is also cited in our briefs, the court held that that knowledge of a disability is imputed to the employer when those are the only reasonable interpretations of the facts. And here, you know, having headaches and a numb arm and stress, that's not necessarily a disability or CFR qualifying. In fact, she admitted in her deposition that her own doctor said that her stress was normal. It's normal stress, nothing wrong with her.
But your understanding, I'm looking now at this regulation, is that the anticipated time has to be volunteered before the employer says anything? as opposed to if asked, you have to provide it? That seems a little odd. I mean, it would be an odd sentence for you to say, you know, I need to take, you're envisioning somebody has to go up to the employer and say, I'm not feeling well and they need to take 16 days off. And that only if she says the second, does the employer have any obligation?
I would say that when you look at what happened here, some vague statements strung together at different periods of time, that you do need something more concrete, like in an anticipated time.
What do you mean by strung together at different periods of time?
Well, at some point in November, she says, I have stress and a numb arm. At a different point in time, she says she had one doctor's appointment. And
I thought at another point in time, she said, I have stress and headaches and a numb arm, but I can't take vacation.
And I can't take a vacation.
But that's not strung. That's one statement. Well, it included all that information.
If we just look at that statement in isolation, I can't take a vacation is a request to take a vacation is to me, I think, too much of a burden to put on a mid-level manager to say, you know what, this might be a statutory request for leave. I better call HR. What he did was he said, Elsa, take it easy.
Take
you
what?
Know, which I
what did he say?
He told her to take it easy. I mean, it to me, to interpret...
Wait, he told her to take what?
Take it easy.
Oh, take
relax.
It easy. Okay.
Don't, you know...
All right, do you want to address stressed?
We did cite other cases in our brief regarding, there were some fact patterns where the employee actually said I needed to be in the hospital for 3 days, and that wasn't enough to signal
that the
employee might need leave.
Well, they knew that she had been in the hospital, actually, right?
Do we know that she was actually in the hospital being treated?
We don't know what
she there was a, there's a there's a there's a brief snippet of a of some notes from somebody at the bank that says I talked to her and she said she was at the hospital, and it's not clear that she's even in the hospital being treated for herself as opposed to being in the hospital visiting someone else. She just couldn't talk at that time. It was my understanding of the statement. It looks like nobody really made any inquiries and she didn't say anything.
Right, and that's part of the strung together information. You know, she's talking about headaches and stress in November, and this comment about being in the hospital for an unknown reason is right before she was terminated in the beginning of February.
These are the recruiter's notes.
Those are the recruiter's notes.
She can't make a decision right now. She's in the hospital, and that's all we've got.
Usually. In the hospital means I'm in the hospital.
Yeah.
I am in the hospital. Right.
Not at the hospital.
Yeah.
I'm in the hospital versus at the hospital. In any event, we don't know why she's there or if it's a C for a qualifying reason. And, the way I see it, she's never requests the time off. She never says, I need to take some time off to take care of this problem.
What about... the prima facie case question, as I asked it. I had understood that the prima facie case requirement was not a showing of competency. It was a showing of qualification in a minimal sense. Didn't she have that?
The element is performing the job satisfactorily.
Where are you getting that from?
That's from McDonnell Douglas. Now,
no, it's not.
In a disability case, qualifications for a position with or without accommodations, you know, I would agree with you on that point.
Because the problem with saying performing the job competently, that's usually the core of the argument. She says, I am providing a competency. They say you're not performing competently, and it's a pretext question. If you front-end it, you're never going to get to the core of the case, and that's not my understanding about how this has ever worked in the last 40 years since McDonnell Douglas. And I will look at McDonnell Douglas, but I don't think it says that.
We have this.
That's how we argue it all the time, at least.
We have this Dinslage case, which has been cited in the briefs, and it states the plaintiff must generally provide evidence, this is the prima facie case, that he was or she was a member of a protected class, two, that she was qualified for the position she sought or was performing competently in the position she held. So that's what the standard is, correct?
Right, and that would make sense to say qualified for a failure to hire case, but in this case, on appeal, we're just talking about the termination, and if you look at the performance timeline, she wasn't performing satisfactorily, and I could go into I broke it down why at mid-year she was needs improvement and why at the end of the year she was low meets, and that's because the metrics are measured on a rolling 3-month basis. By the end of the year in 2011 and 12, she was able to pull it off by the end of the year, which is why she stayed employed. But towards the end of 2013, she wasn't pulling it off. And what the metrics were So what she needs as a minimum standard to not be disciplined or terminated is about 2 units per month and $430,000 in loan origination dollars. Now, that's just the minimum. The goal, what they really want you to do, is actually much higher.
You'd be in a much stronger position if he'd skipped over the prima facie case, which is basically a very low standard. You had a legitimate business purpose for terminating her. And then he'd gotten to the ultimate burden, wouldn't you?
Oh, I agree. Yes, we argued that below. We argued it in our briefs. I don't think there's substantial responsive evidence of pretext here.
But he threw it out at the very initial stage there, where there's a very low burden. Right?
I'm sorry?
He threw it out at the very beginning, where the burden is the lowest. Correct?
Right.
To make a prima facie
right.
case.
Right. And I think that's
why
correct.
Why isn't there a fact there that needs to be resolved?
Why isn't there what I'm
saying? A fact that needs to be resolved there.
I don't think
as
that's
to whether or not she was performing competently.
I don't think that's a tribal issue of fact, because here it's objective metrics.
Here's another question, which is, if she wasn't performing according to these standards, as you said, that doesn't necessarily competent with regard to what? In other words, my understanding is that doesn't necessarily lead to termination. And so the fact that she wasn't meeting her standards as a mortgage broker doesn't prove that she was a generally incompetent employee in general. So I don't understand how you can do this at the prima facie level.
Well,
you're saying it doesn't matter, and it may not. But if we thought that it shouldn't be done at the prima facie level, then we can look at the whole. This was a complete summary judgment. It wasn't limited to prima facie. Your motion was not limited to the prima facie level.
Correct.
So she had to respond completely. And if we thought the district court should not have thrown it out at that level, we could still go forward.
Well, the reason we get from not performing competently to termination is because she wasn't meeting minimum standards. There's a cutoff, and that's in all of the documents, that what the minimum standards are, and the actual goals were much higher.
She wasn't meeting the minimum standards for this particular job, which doesn't lead to the conclusion that she would be terminated. In fact, it wasn't terminated.
She was offered another job.
Right, so therefore it can't be that she you can resolve the case at the prima facie level.
I don't follow that, because she's claiming she was wrongfully terminated. That's the claim here. And what we have objective metrics that she wasn't meeting. It didn't jump to termination. It was performance improvement plan, didn't meet that. Written warning, didn't meet that. And then termination. She was given these opportunities over the course of, almost 6 months. Maybe 5 months.
She hadn't been offered the opportunities. Would that have been sufficient?
I'm sorry?
If she hadn't been offered the opportunities? In other words, that the opportunities have nothing to do with the prima facie case.
Well,
and yet you're relying on them heavily. Why? Because they're proving an absence of pretext, essentially.
I would say both. It goes to the element of performing the job satisfactorily and it goes to pretext because there's no evidence of that here.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We'll give you 1 minute.
Your Honors, two quick responses. With respect to the California Family Rights Act, I do not recall offhand if it's the language in Avila or the cases that Avila relied upon, but you can find plenty of California cases that say there are no magical incantations required in order to request leave. The employer is in the much better position to understand what the employee's rights are and to step forward when they see an employee who has a medical situation and is indicating that they may need leave.
What about the regulation, which does refer to the time period, although it doesn't say specifically that has been set up front?
I would say that the cases have subsequently clearly interpreted the law and regulation to say that, you don't have to check off all these particular boxes. It's, again, that there's no magical incantation. You just need to give some notice that the employer may reasonably interpret as a need for leave so that they can step forward and advise you of your rights. And quickly, with respect to jurisdiction, all this talk now about what the attorney's fees might be, what her salary was, the bottom line was they had the responsibility to bring forward evidence when they removed it. They didn't
Counsel,
do that.
Counsel, you've raised this on appeal for the first time. So didn't you stipulate with the other side that the district court had jurisdiction under diversity?
You cannot stipulate a jurisdiction.
I understand the problem. Didn't you stipulate that the jurisdictional that the district court had jurisdiction under 1332?
In the conference report, the scheduling conference report, I believe it was, they did.
Yeah. So you didn't at that point. It didn't occur to you that you hadn't that they hadn't adequately alleged the $75,000. This is all on appeal, right? It's all later on that
Correct.
You decided that you didn't really have $75,000.
Correct. Sometimes when you look at a case
are you stipulating that you cannot recover more than $75,000?
We are not stipulating.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. The case of Chavez versus JP Morgan is submitted.